Good morning and welcome to Behind the Headlines, the weekly local news roundup from the Salt Lake Tribune and KCPW. Heard around the state on Utah Public Radio, I'm Roger McDonough. Today on the show, we'll look at some election results, get an update on Operation Rio Grande in Salt Lake City. We'll talk about the local response to events in Charlottesville, Virginia last weekend, and also a look at lead contamination in water in Utah schools and more. Joining me for this conversation, Salt Lake Tribune government reporter Courtney Tanner is here in studio. Welcome back, Courtney.
Good morning. Good morning.
Reporter Matt Piper, also from the government desk. Thanks for coming in.
Thank you.
Environment reporter Emma Penrod. Good morning, Emma.
Good morning.
And Salt Lake Tribune columnist Robert Gerke joins us as well. Good morning, Robert.
Good morning.
Listeners, you are invited to join us during this Friday morning news wrap-up with your questions and comments. The number to call is 801-355-TALK. Or you can comment at sltrib.com or the KCPW Facebook page. Let's start today with elections that took place on Tuesday. And a race that we've been watching, of course, is the 3rd District Republican primary. And Courtney Tanner, the winner is?
It's looking like Provo Mayor John Curtis. He declared victory Tuesday night, and the Associated Press called the race for him.
There is, though, and just to kind of touch on this for a moment, the second place finisher in this race, Chris Harrod, still hasn't conceded defeat yet, and that's because he sees a sort of slim possibility of maybe pulling out an upset.
Yeah, Utah County is going to release another round of votes today, and he's kind of holding off for that, saying, you know, I still have a chance. He'd have to really outperform what he did in the first batch of results to win.
Okay, so essentially a very slim chance. And this race was kind of about, maybe I'll turn this to Robert Gerke. You wrote about this race. You kind of saw it as a test case for the Republican Party in Utah, the old way of doing things versus maybe a different way of doing things. Explain this to
right.
us. What does Curtis's victory mean for the Utah GOP?
Well, so if you go back to June, the Republican delegates had their nominating convention. And at that nominating convention, they chose Chris Harrod pretty decisively. Chris is a very very conservative person. He has a hardliner on issues like immigration, and he was sort of one of the original kind of Tea Party members at the Utah legislature during his time there, and you know that resonated with the delegates. Then you fast forward to this week's primary election, and you had two candidates who gathered signatures through the new method of getting on the ballot, gathered enough signatures to get on the primary ballot. You had John Curtis and you had Tanner Ainge. They both gathered signatures. Curtis, we could note, finished, I believe, 5th in the convention, in the nominating convention. He didn't do that well. He was considered a moderate.
Was part of his not so great performance in the nominating convention because of the fact that he gathered signatures?
That was part of it. Yeah, I mean, especially in the Utah County area, the delegates are adamant that the proper way for people to go through and get the nomination is through these conventions and not the signature path. And so Tanner Ainge didn't even go to the convention, so he didn't even compete there. But, you know, John Curtis finished 5th there, and then you fast forward to the election this week, and he beat Chris Harrod pretty decisively, which I think shows that you had 70% of the primary voters who voted for somebody other than the nominee that came out of the convention. That he was just not in line with a typical Republican voter in this 3rd district. And so I think it sends a pretty strong signal that the delegates are indeed out of touch, which is something we've been saying for a long time. They don't represent the view of the average Republican in the district, which I think points to a real problem in the entire idea of a nominating convention being used to choose representatives for these districts. And so in that sense, I think it was a victory for all of the voters in the 3rd district because they actually got to choose a candidate who represents them, and they didn't get stuck with this guy who came out of the nominating convention because he was a more doctrinaire Republican ideologue.
All of this, of course, assuming that the results hold, which it seems very likely they will.
It's going to hold. I mean, Chris Harrod I understand nobody likes to lose. This is sort of one of those things where he's behind by 12%. There's about 42,000 votes left to be counted. he could conceivably. There are enough votes out left to close that 5,200 vote gap, but he would have to just overwhelmingly trounce Curtis and Ainge in the remaining votes. So he'd have to get something like I think it's 48%, almost half of the votes, and they'd have to basically split them for him to actually have a shot at this.
Okay, and there was a lot of and Courtney, I think you covered this, a lot of outside spending against Curtis in this race, and actually, I mean, I guess in favor of Chris Herod might be the way to put it.
Super PAC spent about $880,000 by my last count. It kind of fluctuated there toward the end. Most of that money was kind of pitted against John Curtis, you know, attack ads that called into his credibility of raising taxes or, you know, calling him a Democrat, which he was 20 years ago.
Right.
But yeah, a lot of money that did go to Herod, so Club for Growth out of Washington, D.C., spent a lot to kind of boost his chance.
And I think maybe this was Robert Gerke who wrote about this, but there was one ad that tried to give him an endorsement from, this is Herod, an endorsement from the Deseret News that wasn't really an endorsement.
Yeah, I mean, it kind of bothered me because there was an op-ed, an opinion piece submitted by Sherilyn Eager, who is I called her a Chris Herod fangirl because she's a diehard supporter of Chris Herod's. She's an Eagle Forum sort of member. And so she wrote this column in the Deseret News that said that Chris Herod is the Ronald Reagan of the 3rd District. And they pulled that out and attributed it just to the Deseret News, like the Deseret News said it, which I think is a distortion. I think it's also a distortion of Chris Herod's record, because Chris Herod is a guy who fought the LDS Church over its immigration policy, over its support for the Utah Compact and a compassionate immigration program. Ronald Reagan was a very pro-immigration president. So it's a little ironic. It's also ironic because Ronald Reagan used to be a Democrat, and so did John Curtis, and they beat him up over and over for having been a member of the other party.
Right. I want to remind our listeners that you are invited to join this conversation. You can call us at 801-355-8255. Well, this race is now about John Curtis, Democrat Kathy Allen, and then United Utah Party candidate Jim Bennett. The odds favor the Republican here, Curtis, because of the makeup of this district. Is that right, Courtney?
Yeah, Republicans outnumber Democrats about 6-1 in the district. So Curtis has a really good chance going into this general election.
Gerke, any comments on how that race is shaping up?
Yeah, I mean, it is interesting because Kathy Allen does have a lot of money in the bank right now. And Curtis, the primary, pretty much drained his bank account. So I think she's got about $500,000 sitting in the bank that she had raised, actually, to run against Jason Chaffetz next year. She's going to use that earlier, I guess, than she otherwise would. But it, as Courtney mentioned, it is in one of the most Republican districts in the country. I believe it's the 16th most Republican district, actually. But so Curtis is a decisive favorite to win. You have Jim Bennett in there. It's kind of hard to know who he's going to draw votes from. I suspect it'll probably draw more from the Democrat and maybe some of those unaffiliated voters. Curtis may have some lingering resentment from the right-wing Republicans who maybe won't go out for him, but I still think he's, you know, I would put my money on Curtis to win it at this point.
All right. Well, a couple of months out.
I don't have a lot of money, but I'd put it all on Curtis to win it.
All right. Kind of like putting it on eclipse glasses.
Yeah.
We'll get to that story later on. Matt Piper, this wasn't by any stretch of the imagination the only race around during this recent primary or this recent election, and some city council races, for example, here in Salt Lake City and elsewhere, and mayoral races, trying to provide the individual stories of all of those candidates in all of these races, both here and across the county and elsewhere, would take up the full hour. And so I'll direct people, therefore, to the Salt Lake County elections site at slco.org and also to Tribune coverage on the election, sltrib.com, for more information. But for some of these races, this was just step one, right? The top two vote getters advance in city council elections, for example.
Right. And in the city council elections, there are four races. Two of them involve incumbents, and both of them, Aaron Mendenhall and James Rogers, sort of ran away with the primary, at least. They had, I think Aaron had 75% of the vote, and James had 78%. His challengers have taken sort of a laissez-faire approach to campaigning, and So anyway, those races are not particularly interesting at this moment.
Not competitive.
But I mean, the open races were extremely competitive. And it looks like in District 3, where there's a higher turnout than anywhere else in the county, as of yesterday's batch of ballots that had been returned, Chris Wharton, a civil rights attorney, and Phil Carroll, who's run for council a couple of times before, look like they're going to go ahead to the general there. And in District 7, where there were a half dozen really motivated candidates, it looks like it's going to be Amy Fowler, who previously ran for the seat that was vacated by Justin Miller, the House of the state representative right. seat, and Abe Smith, who has the endorsement of outgoing city councilwoman Lisa Adams.
Are there, you know, if the breakdown of the vote is top vote getter, you know, got, I don't know, 70% of the vote, next vote getter got, or let's say 50-30, is that going to hold through the general election? I mean, is the top vote getter still likely to get the majority in the next round? Does that make sense?
Yeah, no, I see what you're saying. You know, Robert probably has much better perspective here, but one thing that comes to mind is, you know, you're cutting the field from 6 or 5 to 2, you never know where the votes that the other candidates are getting are going to go.
Good
and
point.
So in some of these races, there may be some of the candidates who are trailing may stand to pick up some ground from other like candidates who are now out of the picture.
Yeah, and that, especially in that Chris Wharton, Phil Carroll race, it's so close right now that, you know, they're both, I believe, about 38%. And so that means there's 24% of that went to the other candidates. And so in a race that's just a toss-up like that, where those they're going to be fighting really hard to win over those the votes from not just those 24%, but everybody else in the district as well here between here and the November election.
And especially when there's not a lot of distinguishing positions between candidates, right? I mean, it seems like especially in city council races, generally you have candidates who look a lot like each other in terms of their positions on anything.
Very much so. Yeah, they, you know, fix the streets and clean the air and let's do something about this homeless problem right. is, I think, what you'll hear from, if not all, a very high percentage of city council candidates.
Okay.
And it's interesting because then these campaigns end up getting to be a little bit more personal sometimes, and they also tend to turn on things about, you know, people criticizing the way the other person's campaigning more than about the issues sometimes. And so, you know, we'll watch for that. But yeah, when you have candidates who are, look, these are nonpartisan races technically, but I think they're all cut from the same cloth. And so I think you'll see a lot of overlap between these guys on positions.
Okay. I actually want to turn away from elections and move now to something else that Matt Piper covered, which is Operation Rio Grande as it unfolded. And this is a city, county, state effort in the neighborhood around the downtown homeless shelter. Last week, we talked about jail space, efforts to try and free up jail space for this endeavor because there were slated to be some arrests. But Matt, just maybe remind us what this operation was all about, a kind of crackdown on crime in this district of Salt Lake City.
Right. So in the area surrounding the homeless shelter, if you're not familiar with it, you probably haven't seen it. But for a long time, there were a number of people congregating outside of the homeless shelter at 210 South Rio Grande Street next to the Gateway Mall. Many of them were involved in drug use. It's often referred to as an open-air drug market where you could go and just, if you spend a matter of minutes there, you could sort of figure out how the deals were going down. It was a strange, strange place to find in Utah, I think many people felt. And certainly business owners and area residents have long said that that somebody needs to do something about it. Salt Lake City, despite its best efforts, has said, you know, we just didn't have the resources necessary to make a lasting impact on this area. You know, they tried last fall with Operation Diversion, where they had a series of sweeps and they gave low-level drug offenders a choice between treatment or jail.
Right.
Well, now they have all the resources that the state and county and city could possibly bring to bear with Operation Rio Grande. It's a plan to be a 2-year effort with multiple law enforcement agencies, promised treatment beds coming online up to 200, and then a third phase that so far has been sort of vaguely defined but would be a sort of employment phase and get people back to work.
So far, though, we were looking at, I mean, as far as Operation Rio Grande has gone to date, we've been looking mostly at police action, right? And there were a number of arrests, and were these of, you know, arrests of big fish drug dealers and hardened criminals, or who was picked up?
Well, I don't know definitively the answer to that, but what seems to be the case is that there were over 200 arrests. I can't think of the exact number off the top of my head through the first 3 days. Many of them were drug arrests, but I don't think that we're talking about big fish so much as lower level drug dealers and users who previously weren't able to be booked into the jail because there wasn't space for them there.
Were they booked into jail? And I mean, is it when we say arrests, do we mean arrests and sort of holding in jail, or arrest and release, which happens often with drug offenses?
So they've said that those who have been who are still in jail are guilty, or they're charged. I'm sorry.
Yeah.
They're certainly not proven guilty, but they're charged with Class A misdemeanors or felonies. And those who are charged with Class B or C misdemeanors have been released. So The Class A misdemeanors is a fairly serious crime, and they do have a fairly substantial number of people who they've charged with crimes like that. I think as of yesterday, 18 had been charged with felonies, which isn't a super high number, but, you know, again, those are serious crimes, and that's, you know, 18 people that they think are guilty of serious crimes who are, as of now, off the streets.
Okay. You know, in reporting that led up to this action, we read about consultation with the American Civil Liberties Union of Utah by some state leaders. Consultation actually might be a bit of a strong word. And as it turns out, the ACLU isn't exactly endorsing what's been happening in Operation Rio Grande. Tell us about that.
Yeah, I think consultation is fair. Speaker Hughes had mentioned, Speaker Greg Hughes, who sort of spearheaded this whole effort, had mentioned from the beginning of his little office there at the south end of the Gateway Mall that he calls his war room. When he first started convening these meetings, he said, look, we're bringing in the ACLU. We want to do this in a way that is constitutionally sound. We don't want to screw this up. And they did. They did bring in the ACLU. But the extent to which the ACLU is on board with this was sort of clarified by this statement that the ACLU released earlier this week, where they said, you know, this doesn't, we didn't sanction this, we didn't okay this, and what we see so far looks a lot like, you know, law enforcement and nothing else. So even though treatment is promised, they sort of they put a little pressure on the leadership to follow through with that promise.
In this multi-phase operation, which sort of began, it seems, with law enforcement actions, is there funding in place for those long-term efforts for, you know, additional treatment options?
Yeah, the funding is an interesting question. We have had very few details about funding, and I think that maybe we'll get a little bit more clarity next week. But as of now, where it's coming from, we don't know. But we have heard that 37 new treatment beds would come online within a couple of weeks, and up to 200 could come online by next spring, when they expect to have received the Medicaid waiver from the Trump administration.
We need to go to a break shortly, but Robert Gerke, just you know, to get your comments on this so far. As Matt's pointing to, this isn't about homelessness per se. It's about crime around the homeless who are down there. Phase one, before Salt Lake County Sheriff Jim Winder left, he was pretty fond of saying that we can't arrest our way out of homelessness. We've also, through the years, had a hard time arresting our way out of the drug problem. There always seems to be, if you know, the drug trade is a market dynamic more than it is a criminal dynamic in some ways.
Yeah, I think they acknowledge that they can't arrest their way out of it, but they're trying to force it into another, you know, they're trying to remove that element from the downtown area so they can actually start caring for and treating some of the homeless people that actually need access to these services and are otherwise being preyed on by the criminal element down there. I think the only frustrating thing about it is, you know, Matt mentioned Operation Diversion, which was, I believe, about a year ago when we first started seeing these. I don't understand why they couldn't have brought these resources to bear before, but there was just this constant infighting between the different parties. They couldn't all get on the same page, and now they finally have, which is great. But, you you know, if we had sustained Operation Diversion when they did it before, we would be a year down the road that we aren't now. And also the treatment element, I think we need to stay focused on that as well, because they really do need to get this Medicaid waiver approved so they can get coverage for treatment for a lot of these people who otherwise wouldn't be able to get it. And if once they get it, it's not going to be sustained unless they get that Medicaid funding to come through. And so that's a top priority right now, I think.
Okay. Guys, yeah, I'll mention that there are also some interesting stories by Salt Lake Tribune reporter Christopher Smart from this week on the origin of some of the drugs, the heroin that is on the streets in Salt Lake City that ties into this. So for further background, check that out. At the moment, though, we need to move on to other stories from this past week's news. Before that, we need to take a quick break. You're listening to Behind the Headlines here on KCPW and Utah Public Radio. We'll be right back.
You're listening to Behind the Headlines on KCPW. For podcasts and more local shows and lectures, follow us on iTunes or visit the Local Shows tab at kcpw.org.
Welcome back to Behind the Headlines. I'm Roger McDonough with KCPW, and I'm joined by Salt Lake Tribune environment reporter Emma Penrod and columnist Robert Gerke right now. You can call us with your questions and comments at 801-355-8255. And thanks to Matt Piper and Courtney Tanner, who joined us earlier in the show. And let's turn to some stories on the environment desk now. And Emma Penrod, to begin with, you wrote a story about lead contamination in water in Utah schools. That seems like a pretty serious topic. What's the gist of this story, Emma?
Yeah, so this is something that has been a concern for the last, you know, year or two nationwide. The concern is that many schools are older buildings. They're large buildings where, you know, water can sit stagnant in pipes for long periods of time over holidays, over the summer break. And that when this happens, the pipes can start to corrode a little bit and leach, you know, various metals, including, of course, lead into the drinking water that is then consumed by the children at the school. And so the state had asked, you know, just kind of a couple of school districts at random if they wouldn't mind maybe just running some tests on their drinking water to see, you know, what kind of lead might be in there. And based on those spot checks, it turned out that the school's water was about twice as likely to, you know, to exceed the EPA's standards for lead in drinking water. Mm. Than were other samples that are routinely collected throughout the state. So looking at that, the state has decided to, you know, they've sent out a letter that has urged all the school districts, all the public schools in Utah to, you know, follow up and continue this testing to ensure that there aren't, you know, potentially harmful levels of lead in the drinking water at schools.
And this contamination, I mean, the levels of lead that they're seeing, we assume that it's coming from older lead pipes, right? Is that the idea?
That is the assumption. It'd be coming from old lead pipes or, you know, various old plumbing fixtures that contain lead. There was one school that, you know, tested above the action level, which is what the EPA's standard in this case is called. And it turned out it was a pipe. It was a sink. You know, that appeared to be the source of the problem. And so I understand that the sink and the plumbing that was associated with that sink was replaced, and they're in the process of retesting to see if that has removed the problem.
For those that weren't at or above that EPA threshold, but also had relatively high levels of lead, what's being done at those particular schools to try and solve the problem?
Well, the action and the focus right now is on the 10 schools that did exceed the EPA's standard, although slightly, you know, just about half of the schools tested during the spot check so far did contain some level of lead contamination.
Sorry, and actually that's the question I should really ask, is what's being done at those other schools then that have exceeded that threshold, other than, you know, there's that sink you mentioned, but in the 9 other schools?
It depends on the school, because this is a voluntary program. The state doesn't have the authority, or at least state regulators don't have the authority to force the schools to do anything. And most schools have taken the approach of they flush the pipes out to get any stagnant water that may have, you know, allowed the lead to accumulate out of the system before school starts, so that the kids can return to, you know, safe drinking water. And they're going to continue to flush at various intervals, you know, to avoid allowing the lead to build up. And then over time, they're going to continue monitoring the situation and see if perhaps they can't locate the source of the problem. In Granite School District, where 7 of these schools were located. My understanding is that they plan to pursue a bond this fall that would enable them to remodel those schools.
Can we talk just for a moment about the effects of lead on human health and specifically on kids' developmental issues, right?
Right. Lead is a problem because once it leaves your once it enters your body, it never leaves. So it's what they say, it bioaccumulates throughout your lifespan. And as it builds up in your body, once it reaches a certain point, it starts affecting various organs, in particular the nervous system, which can result in behavioral problems, memory loss, difficulty focusing, loss of IQ, and general developmental issues, including, you know, not only like mental health developmental issues, but also physical growth.
I'm just thinking, you know, there's a request by the state for schools to schools, districts and schools to test their water. But school is going into session and is in session in some schools. When will this testing happen? And I guess if I'm a parent, how do I ensure that my kids are safe in the meantime?
Right. So the state's this is the Division of Drinking Water that's trying to push this initiative. And the Division of Drinking Water doesn't have the authority, it doesn't have jurisdiction over schools, so it can't force the schools to do anything.
Right.
But they have requested that the schools get the testing done before Labor Day, which is coming up.
Yeah.
So a short deadline if they, you know, choose to participate. You know, parents can, of course, you know, contact the Division of Drinking Water, which has said it will, you know, provide information to the parents as far as, you know, what kind of data has been collected on their school, what those test results might look like.
Okay.
As well as they could possibly contact the school administrators to, you know, see when and if testing might be done.
Okay. Robert Gerke, we've got you in studio here. This is maybe part of a reality of our aging infrastructure, I guess. I don't know. A troubling situation, though.
Well, I mean, I think we can all be grateful that it's not risen to the level that we saw in Flint, Michigan or something like that, right. You know, but it is good that they're kind of trying to stay on top of this. And yeah, I mean, when you have these infrastructure, when you have these pipes like they did in Flint that are dated and that they sit for a long time, you've got to be careful. And I think it's good that they're trying to be vigilant, at least. As Emma mentioned, when these things bioaccumulate, you don't want to have any traces in there because they'll just pile up over time. So they got to get on top of it, and it's going to take some money and resources and time to do it.
Okay. Again, listeners, join us with your thoughts and questions. 801-355-TALK is the number to call. You can comment at sltrib.com or at the KCPW Facebook page. Emma, I want to stick with some reporting that you did from this past week and move away from this story on lead contamination. You've got an interesting beat because you also wrote about some relatively new invasive insects that are showing up across Utah. And it's a story that I'm intimately familiar with. I've been dealing with these bugs all summer. But what are we talking about and where did they come from?
Yeah, the state in 2014 identified the elm seed bug in Utah, which is from the believe someplace in the Mediterranean originally, maybe Italy. It's has a tendency to spread around, so it's not entirely clear exactly where it's originally from.
Okay.
But it is not native to Utah. They believe it maybe came in on some, you know, shipping boxes or something of that nature.
Just a few years ago, right?
Mm-hmm. And it has since established itself, and it is now showing up in people's homes over the summer where it goes into the homes to probably escape the summer heat here.
Okay.
And it can enter in fairly large numbers. It's relatively harmless, but I understand it can make a bad odor that some people don't appreciate.
It can if you smash them. You know, I guess the question that I have is what sort of advice is out there about, I mean, how do we stop them, Emma? What do we do to combat these bugs?
Well, unfortunately, the experts on this are saying they can be kind of difficult to control because the main issue is you want to keep them from entering your home. You would probably prefer to keep them outdoors. But they're very small, and so they will find any kind of little crack or crevice around your doors or windows in particular, and that's how they will enter the house. So the first line of defense is to make sure that all those cracks are sealed around especially windows. Apparently that's their preferred method of entry.
Easier said than done, Emma.
Yeah, they're very small insects, so they, you know, can get in small spaces.
And then elm tree bugs. Does this mean that if you've got a species of elm next to your house, you're inviting them to congregate? I don't know, to gather, and then is that part of the problem?
Possibly. They feed on elm seeds in particular, and so if you have large elm trees in the neighborhood, this probably about with a block radius is what I've been told, that will kind of bring them into the area. One part of the advice to possibly prevent these from getting into your home is to clean up any, elm seeds or litter or debris around the house to prevent them from being attracted to a food source.
Okay. Are they, and this is kind of an odd question, but are they harming elm trees the way that, say, pine bark beetles do, or anything along those lines? I know that we don't have as many elm trees as we have pine trees.
Well, again, my understanding is that they eat the seeds, so they don't believe they eat the bark or anything of that nature.
Robert Gerke, the obvious question for you here is this an overlooked protein source?
I like the idea of Roger smashing all these bugs in his house, right? just being driven mental by these bugs. I think it's great.
It's happening. Okay, I say we eat them. Emma Penrod, thanks again for this reporting. We are going to have to move on to other topics from this past week's news after another quick break, namely local rallies against racism and hate and a look at the reopening of the Utah Museum of Fine Arts. This is Behind the Headlines, the weekly news wrap-up from the Salt Lake Tribune and KCPW. We'll be back shortly.
You're listening to Behind the Headlines on KCPW. For podcasts and more local shows and lectures, follow us on iTunes or visit the Local Shows tab at kcpw.org.
Welcome back to Behind the Headlines. I'm Roger McDonough with KCPW Public Radio, and I am joined for the remainder of the hour by Emma Penrod from the Salt Lake Tribune. Okay, Salt Lake Tribune's Emma Penrod, also Robert Gerke, and a recent addition to the lineup. Joining us in studio right now, Salt Lake Tribune movie critic Sean P. Means. And Sean, welcome to you.
Hi, thanks.
Thanks for being here. Listeners, call us up with your questions and comments. Again, the number is 801-355-TALK or comment at sltrib.com or the KCPW Facebook page. We've got Sean here for a conversation about the reopening of the Utah Museum of Fine Arts following a year and a half of closure, and we will go to that story soon, but I want to quickly touch on something else that happened this past week. It's something that had a lot of coverage. We covered it on our Thursday morning program In the Hive, and that's a plug. Check it out at kcpw.org. The Utah response to what transpired at a racist march in Charlottesville, Virginia. There were two rallies, a rally at the Capitol that was sponsored by the Utah GOP called a Unity Rally, and then there was one at the Salt Lake City and County Building put on by the League of Native American Voters called a Solidarity Rally, sort of competing events, maybe a couple of thousand in attendance at the latter compared to a couple of hundred at the former. And there was the response from Utah politicians. Representative Mia Love was at that event at the Capitol and talked about her own experience with racism. We heard from Senator Orrin Hatch, who spoke about his brother dying fighting fascists and rejecting fascist ideas. Senator Mike Lee had some very strong words for the president. And that's where I want to go with this. It's a long lead-in, Robert Gerke, but I don't have the reporters who wrote about everything that I've just described here in studio with me, but I've got you equivocating from the president on this rally in Charlottesville, and that has led to a lot of criticism, some of it from Utah quarters.
Yeah, I mean, the comments that the president made, I think, were pretty roundly condemned by pretty much everybody, including, I mean, you know, he when he talked about the, you know, many sides being involved, or and then tried to clean it up and actually maybe made it worse by talking about the alt-left and both sides being, you know, the people who were at these rallies, I think the main message from both rallies was that we don't, you know, abide by neo-Nazis, white supremacists, racists, the Ku Klux Klan. We don't accept that, you know, that philosophy in our communities here. And so it was, I believe, not just a statement to, you know, not just a protest against what the president said, which you could certainly justify protesting, I think, but also, you know, sort of a show of solidarity, as they put it, and, you know, the community coming together to sort of rebuke these racist viewpoints. Mm.
And that false equivalence, giving equal weight to, say, neo-Nazis and those who opposed them, that was kind of at the heart of why these rallies happened around the country. I mean, obviously the response was to the rally that occurred there, but also to the aftermath from the president's statements.
Yeah, I mean, the violence in Charlottesville, I think, was maybe an underlying cause of this. But also, you know, as I wrote in my column, when the president doesn't speak forcefully on these issues, the public kind of has to step in and make clear that that's, you know, that this is the way people feel. And you saw some pretty eloquent remarks from people like Spencer Cox at the Republican one, and there were a number of speakers at the one at the city county building, who all sort of made the point that, yeah, this has no place in our community. And regardless what the president says and how he sort of botches this or, you know, goes easy on the racists, that as a community in Salt Lake City and in Utah, that we're not going to stand for it.
Okay, well, before we move on, what about the way that as Americans we are treating these groups, the openly racist groups that are out there, like the these neo-Nazis or white nationalists, the alt-right? Less overt forms of racism, like systemic racism, are far more widespread. And I guess what I'm wondering is if in some way we might not be empowering neo-Nazis with, say, the anti-fascist response that can be confrontational, even violent.
We could spend a whole hour talking about
just,
this.
Yeah.
I think
we got to get to Sean B. Means here.
But I think you're right. I think that the focus on Charlottesville and the focus on this march probably obscures the larger discussion that we need to have. But I think we need to kind of let things calm down a little bit before we start having those discussions. I think neo-Nazis, this may be an unpopular viewpoint, but I think they're entitled to their own wrong-headed viewpoints, and they can think what they want to think, and they can be as wrong as anybody else. I think, you know, it doesn't do us a lot of good to start busting them in the heads like we've seen in some of the violent encounters out there. But I think we need to have a discussion, and I think it is a little disturbing that the rise of Donald Trump has given a confidence, an air of confidence to these groups that otherwise, you know, they've existed in this country for centuries, but, you know, now I think we've seen them willing or feeling empowered to come out into the light with it like we haven't seen before. So we've always had these elm bugs with us, and we're always going to have racists with us, and we've got to kind of maybe, you can't squish them, but you've got to confront them in a different way.
Well, the elm bugs are new. I'm sorry to ruin your analogy, but they're, at least here they're new. But this is our reality in 2017, and thanks, Robert, for those comments. Yeah. Sean P. Means, I'm sorry to keep you waiting and now to take this drastic turn away from that part of the conversation to, you know, actually maybe a dose of arts is exactly what we need here. You've been covering, you are covering the reopening of the Utah Museum of Fine Arts. You're the Salt Lake Tribune movie critic, but you also cover the arts beat. And I know you've got a feature that's actually coming out this weekend. It's a museum that has been closed for a while now, more than a year and a half, but is slated to reopen really soon. First off, why did they close?
Well, it happened about 2 years ago. They started to realize that the building was having problems. A museum has to have a certain humidity level inside to keep the artwork preserved. If you open the doors to the high desert air we have here, the artwork would start to dry out and paint would flake off and other bad things would happen. So to keep to museum standards, you have to keep the humidity up to a certain level. That takes its toll on the building, especially in a place like Utah where it's very thin, dry air. And the John and Marsha Price museum building up there was having trouble. They were worried that it would start, that the infrastructure inside would start rusting, the iron inside would start rusting. And they were seeing mineral deposits accumulating outside the building from the moisture that was escaping. So the building experts up at the U said, okay, we got to do something about this. They had to, so they closed the building to basically rebuild inside to do with the vapor barrier, they call it, and to upgrade that and to also upgrade the heating and air conditioning systems. While they were closed, the people who run the museum, because they weren't busy with the day-to-day of running, of showing art to people, they took a step back and said, okay, this is a chance to reimagine and rethink how we do what we do, how we show art, how we display art to the community, where we put the galleries and that sort of thing. And so they did a sort of top-to-bottom examination of how the art is displayed in the museum, how they take care of the 20,000 objects that are in their collection, and so they've done a reimagining of that.
When it reopens, I mean, it's slated to reopen in this month.
Next weekend, okay. August 26th and 27th, they're doing a big two-day party for that. So,
For those of us who have visited in the past, how will this museum have changed? You talked about the re-envisioning, reimagining of what this space is. What are we going to see? Can you give us a preview, or is it all top secret?
They're very happy to talk about it. They're actually very eager for people to see it because it's been closed for a year and a half, and they're in the business of showing art. And they haven't been able to do that, and they're getting a little stir crazy up there, actually, in the happiest way, you know. For example, in the past, the first floor, the sort of ongoing exhibits, what you would call permanent galleries, on the first floor used to be always the old European masters, you know, because. Mm-hmm. And the American and the Utah art would be upstairs somewhere because of this inferiority complex that the Europeans did it all right and the Americans don't know how to do art. That's changed. The sort of signature galleries on the first floor are now going to be regional and American art, including a lot of Utah made art. That's one thing. The modern and contemporary gallery is in its regular place on the second floor for the next year. Every piece of work in the modern and contemporary gallery is going to be done by a woman artist, trying to open up the conversation to say that the art scene, especially in the last century, has been more than just, you know, Warhol and Lichtenstein and Rauschenberg and all the men, but included again are some women artists. Amongst the women artists, there are included some Utah artists: Jan Hayworth, Angela Ellsworth, Anna Campbell Bliss. So that's another example. Another thing is that they have put in three sort of conversation nook areas within the museum. One in the front entrance that will sort of hook to the state's land art, like Spiral Jetty and Sun Tunnels, which UMFA also is the stewardship of. And these are places where people can gather and sort of take a break from walking around and looking at art and sort of have and there are going to be interactive things that people can do to sort of think about the art. And also in three of the galleries, all the placards and all the words that are next to the art are going to be in English and Spanish.
Okay. How expensive? I mean, this was something that they needed to do because they needed to fix, as you said, the problems with the building that had to do with moisture and air conditioning, et cetera. Was there any additional cost? I mean,
oh yeah.
Okay, how expensive was this?
The state put up $2.5 million in the capital budget for the building fix. For the gallery aspect of it, they've raised money privately and so far have raised $2.3 million in donations for that aspect of it.
Okay. I actually want to turn to some other things that you wrote this week, but just when are they kicking off this reopening and what kind of events will they have?
It's going to be on the 26th and 27th. They're going to be open like 10 to midnight both days, and they're going to have a dance party Saturday night. They're going to have yoga Sunday morning. They're going to have a pinata bash on Saturday out front. There are two new exhibits that are opening. There's an installation work in the Great Hall that is quite fascinating. And then they have this new Acme Lab, which is a place for sort of interactive and community based art. And they've brought in this sister duo of artists who are creating a space that people can come in and play with the stuff and wear it and do all the touchy stuff that you aren't allowed to do in the rest of the galleries.
Right. So. Well, it's interesting, Sean. Check it out, the new Utah Museum of Fine Arts. Since we have you for a little bit of time left and we have you here in studio, you also this week wrote about some filmed in Utah projects that are out now or that are coming soon. Among those, a crime thriller called Wind River. This is a Utah-made movie that's opening or is already open.
Wind River opens today in Utah markets. It's open elsewhere nationwide. It's opening today in Salt Lake. And then the other one that's opening today in Salt Lake is called Brigsby Bear, which is a comedy starring Kyle Mooney from Saturday Night Live, who also wrote it.
Did that have a Utah component?
It was all filmed here. People were last year. If you were on social media, you may have wondered why that Saturday Night Live guy was at Pine Beer Day at the beer bar. This is why.
Okay.
a very funny comedy, has a good cast, includes Greg Kinnear. Mark Hamill was here for it.
Who's that? Just kidding, I'm joking.
Well, it was hilarious because he was here at the same time that every billboard in town had his picture because he was going to be at Comic-Con.
Right. So he was here filming. Okay, so these are some filmed in Utah projects. Mm-hmm. Are we seeing more and more projects filmed in Utah?
There seems to be sort of there's always stuff happening. I mean, for years and years, you go back to the John Ford Monument Valley movies in the 30s and 40s. You go to Thelma and Louise in the 90s. The film community here is always got something going on. There seems to be sort of a surge of projects. You've got those two movies opening this week. 2 weeks ago, we had We Love You, Sally Carmichael, which is a comedy written by a Utah comic, Darren Tufts, that was filmed here with Christopher Gorham as the lead and also the director.
Of all of these movies, which one should we absolutely go see?
Wind River is definitely the best of the lot. It's Taylor Sheridan is the director, and it's his third screenplay, and his first two were Sicario and Hell or High Water.
All right.
And it's a murder mystery on an Indian reservation in Wyoming. They filmed it here because it's slightly easier to get crews up the mountains in Utah than it is in Wyoming.
Park City mostly, right?
Mostly around Park City and the Park City Film Studios. And matter of fact, Sheridan just started work this week on a new TV series called Yellowstone. With Kevin Costner. If you're up in Park City and you happen to see Kevin Costner in the Whole Foods, that's why. it's a new series. It's sort of a Dallas Dynasty sort of soap opera thing, set in a ranch that is right next to Yellowstone National Park.
Well, who shot JR? All right,
exactly. Well, we'll find out. Yeah. But it's got a big cast, and it's gonna debut next January on the new Paramount cable network, which is where Spike TV will soon not be.
Okay. I actually wanted to save time to talk about how incentives play into the center of the Utah Film Commission gives out grants to filmmakers or certain money is awarded to filmmakers. If you can quickly, before we turn to our underplayed stories, tell us about
that. There's about 20% tax incentive if you make movies here and can go up to 25% if you use Utah crews. That is a big incentive to bring a lot of movies. Okay. To film here.
And there's a lot of competition between Utah and New Mexico, and they're trying to jockey back and forth, and they keep putting more and more money into it every session, it seems like. I think they've got something like $10.5 million in the fund now.
Right. And they're competing against the big boys like Louisiana and Georgia right now. So.
Different terrain, though, right? Maybe that doesn't matter as much anymore.
Red Rocks help.
All right. Well, guys, we are out of time, and so let's turn now to our underplayed stories of the week, and I'll stick with Sean Means. If you got one, do you have an underplayed story?
I was going to say if you were looking for Kevin Costner, but okay. that's the one I had. So
I like it. All right. We'll move on to Robert Gerke then. Your pick for underplayed story of the week.
Well, I think, we talked a little bit about the racism and the fallout from the Charlottesville thing, and I think the statement that the LDS Church made this week on about how the teachings of the faith are not conducive to, the alt-right beliefs and the racist beliefs is really interesting because it does sort of set the stage for there has been, a strain of Mormonism that embraces these viewpoints. And so now it puts some pressure on the church and on these people these proponents of these views to kind of come into line and see if there's going to be any fallout from the church kind of making a pretty definitive statement that they won't tolerate that.
Mm. Really interesting story there. Emma Penrod, your pick for underplayed story of the week.
Yeah, so apparently the National Park Service has reversed a 2011 policy that allowed certain individual parks, if they chose to ban water bottles, plastic bottles, to try to reduce waste, litter, these kinds of problems. Apparently there were health concerns. They felt like this took all the healthy beverages off the shelves, but that the unhealthy beverages were still available. And so they're going to no longer allow that, and water will be sold.
Wow, so you could buy, say, a plastic Coke bottle, but not a plastic water bottle at some of these places?
That was apparently the issue.
Wow, okay. That's been undone. For my pick, I'm going to go with the Miller family. This is a story that Matt Piper wrote in the Salt Lake Tribune. The Miller family matching up to $10 million in donations. This is for a story that we were talking about just earlier, the Operation Rio Grande. This is actually for services at new shelters that are slated to open. $10 million match, essentially. So you can read that at Salt Lake Tribune.
Matching dollar for dollar for up to $10 million. I think it has the potential to really make a profound difference in what we were talking about, the service oriented end of this equation. So
because again, we don't know exactly the funding structure yet, but this is part of it. I mean, private donations are part of it apparently for.
Yeah, I think it's going to the group Shelter the Homeless, and then again, the match is kind of a key part of it. So we're talking about potentially $20 million of resources that weren't there before, and now we're going to be able to get treatment and both substance abuse and mental health treatment, and hopefully move into this phase three job-oriented program that they've talked about as well. So it's a big deal, and Gail Miller and the Miller family should be praised for it, I think.
All right, that's Robert Gierke. Guys, we are out of time, but Robert Gierke, Emma Penrod, Sean P. Means, and then earlier in the show we had Matthew Piper and Courtney Tanner, but all from the Salt Lake Tribune. Thanks, guys, for coming in and spending the hour with
Great.
Us.
Great. Thank you. Have a good weekend.
That does it for this edition of Behind the Headlines. I want to thank Jesse Ellis here at KCPW. Up in Logan at Utah Public Radio, the broadcast is managed by Tom Williams, Spencer Holsey, Alyssa Roberts, and Christy Aachen. And thanks, as always, are due to the show's producer, Emily Means. And again, you can check out her new show, In the Hive, which this week looked at the rallies against racism. That airs Thursday mornings at 10 and then again on Sundays at noon. Check that out at kcpw.org. Find podcasts of that show and of this one also at our website, kcpw.org, or via your favorite podcast app. I'm Roger McDonough. Thanks very much again for joining us, and have a great weekend. Enjoy the eclipse.